This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Basketball is a cultural cornerstone of Indiana. If you need evidence of this, look no further than the number of high school gyms in Indiana that seat over 7,000 fans. Among the top 10 biggest high school gyms in the country, Indiana has 9. Today, we're exploring Indiana's love affair with basketball, and we'll start the conversation talking about those places communities go to watch games. If you have any questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is the chief videographer at WTIU in Bloomington, Seth Tackett. Seth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Seth, for years, Newcastle's high school gym was considered the biggest. I've been there. I can attest to it. And not just in Indiana, but the biggest in the country. How big are we talking?
It was, for the longest time, it was considered number one with 9,325 seats.
My goodness, it's enormous. Right. And for reference, the population in Newcastle is about 18,000 people, according to the census that was taken in 2010. So we're talking about a little right around half the town being able to fit in this gym. How many other gyms in Indiana are comparable?
Well, there was the Wigwam in Anderson, which was kind of the second place the whole time and actually was probably the biggest in the state. And then Seymour, Richmond, East Chicago, Elkhart, there's a number of them.
And Wikipedia's most current list of the biggest high school gyms in the U.S. has 9 of the 10 biggest gyms listed in Indiana, as we said. But that, it's that top spot that changed recently. Does Newcastle no longer claim that top spot?
That's correct. And it all comes down to temporary seating. Doug Bradley and Richard Tacolvi of the Indiana Historical Basketball Society were always counting seats. They've been counting seats since the early 90s, and there's always kind of like rumor and innuendo and conjecture that, hey, they didn't think Newcastle was number one. Well, that was actually true, much to the chagrin of some Newcastle fans. And like I said earlier, Anderson, the Wigwam, was probably the biggest, but they set out to set the record straight. They started counting. And it was temporary seating that kind of tipped the balance and made Seymour number one.
I want to come back to counting seats, but what happened to the Wigwam?
It closed in 2011, financial issues.
Yeah. And what was it connected? What school was it connected to?
Sorry, it was Anderson.
Oh, it was Anderson High School.
Anderson High School.
Yeah. And when was the Wigwam constructed? How long was it around?
It'd been around for decades. I don't know the exact date.
But, okay, so when you go back to counting seats, and it was counting seats that determined that Seymour had a slight advantage over Newcastle, which if you've been to Newcastle, it's hard to believe. I've actually not been to Seymour. I guess what is the process of counting seats look like?
I've been to Seymour, but I have not been to Newcastle. I tried to get up there for the video, but they declined comment on the story, unfortunately. But basically, it comes down to like the width, and you know how long the seats are, how many seats are temporary, how many seats are taken out for the press, and so on and so forth. And Seymour's seats were permanent.
And it comes down to it's not so easy as just going through and counting seats, right? There's more to it because we're talking about bleachers and you can sometimes fit more people on bleachers.
Right. And if you have time, check out the video. It shows Richard going through and counting, and he also brought blueprints of both Seymour and Newcastle, and kind of on the perimeter or the outer rim of Newcastle was all the temporary seating that they had brought in for the sectionals, regionals, the semi-states. And, you know, those bleachers are no longer there. They're, you know, according to the guys I interviewed, out in the middle of the football, behind the football field, you know, resting. And so that was the seats weren't permanent was the issue.
So that was what put it over the top, the fact that you're talking permanent versus temporary seating.
Yeah, there was a lot of questions like on Facebook and stuff. How do you lose seats? How do you gain seats? So that was like the big question for fans.
So is there an official group that kind of keeps these records?
The Indiana Historical Basketball Society. I spoke with John Ockman. He was the former president. And Doug Bradley, he's down in Florida now. And Richard Tacolvi's over in North Vernon. And they're just diehard basketball junkies.
Yeah. How seriously do they take this? I mean, this is a process for them.
Yeah. John Ockman still writes for thehickoryhusker.com occasionally. There's a lot of basketball guys on that website. And, you know, they talk almost like a barber shop, but it's on, you know, a website, and they talk about Indiana high school basketball. And the seeding was always a big topic, and John wanted to set the record straight, so he encouraged Doug to come forward with his findings, and Richard as well.
Seth, are you yourself a basketball fan?
I am. I grew up in Bedford in the late 80s and early 90s, and that was the time of Damon Bailey.
And so what was it like? Did you nerd out with these guys talking Indiana hoops?
Oh, absolutely. Kirk Manns, the athletic director and basketball coach at Seymour, played at Michigan State in the late 80s and early 90s. And my brother played for BNL. They beat Jeffersonville in four overtimes at Seymour. So it was special to do the video for me.
How did they announce that it was Seymour rather than Newcastle that had the top spot?
That's a good question. It was just he put it up. John had the article put up on HickoryHusker.com, and it didn't get much, nobody's really talking about it. But, you know, of course, now it's all about social media, and it blew up on Facebook when it was put up on the Facebook page.
And for people who aren't familiar, Hickory Huskers were the fictional team that were depicted in Hoosiers. What is HickoryHusker.com then?
That's kind of a basketball website for junkies. They talk about a lot of different things. They're discussed and records and things of that nature. Coaching changes and players and all conference, stuff like that.
When it was announced that it was Seymour, that Seymour took the top spot, what was the reaction from people in the community?
Yeah, it was interesting editing the video and going through some of those Facebook posts, because it was basically you had a bunch of Newcastle fans and you had a bunch of Seymour fans, and they were taking shots at the gyms, and then a lot of people did bring up the temporary seating and how do you lose seats, and did Seymour renovate? And basically the answer is no. It was because Newcastle had been counting temporary seating, which was also because of ticket sales. So that was, I should have pointed that out earlier. Earlier, those seating records were based on ticket sales, and then after they started counting and like, wait a minute, this is temporary seating, these records are different. Newcastle dropped down to number three.
So it sounds like people got pretty passionate in the argument.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were. And, you know, they talked about the seat width. And if you're in Seymour, then you're basically sitting on top of everybody that you're sitting next to. And they were talking about the different basketball games they'd seen at Newcastle. And Newcastle has a lot of history with Kent Benson and Steve Alford. And Seymour does as well, with all the Mr. Basketballs that have gone through there, from Pat Graham, Romeo Langford, Damon Bailey, Sharon Wilkerson. So a lot of point to history.
Outside of community pride, was or is there a practical advantage to being able to say that you have the biggest gym? Did this ever influence where games were played?
Yeah, when I spoke to Tom McKinney, he's former coach at Bloomington North. He coached the last single-class state champ at Bloomington North in 1997. He also teaches the history of Indiana basketball at IU. And when you have those bigger gyms, you host the sectional and regionals in the semi-state. You could possibly. So it's definitely an advantage to have those parts of the tournament at home.
I got started in radio doing stringer reporting on high school basketball games, and so I got to visit a lot of these big gymnasiums. Like my high school didn't have a huge gymnasium. We had what I think is probably a moderate or average-sized gym. But when I saw places like, is it the Bowl in Connersville? Is that what they call it? And then, of course, Newcastle, I was just blown away. I couldn't believe it. What are some of the ones that you remember visiting?
I used to work for the Herald Times as well as a sports reporter, and some of the cooler gyms I ever witnessed a couple games in was White River Valley and Springs Valley. Kind of how you start out, you walk out, and then the gym recesses down into the floor, and so people sit around the court. So that I was always a big fan of those gyms. And, you know, I sound like a bit of a homer, but I always liked BNL's gym, Bedford North Lawrence.
And when we're talking about between 7,000 and 8,000 seats, was it common back in the day for these gyms to fill up to that capacity?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's my understanding from when it was class basketball and you had all the towns and coming together to, you know, fight for the sectional championship. It was big. And that, and a lot of people noted that, that the attendance has gone down since class basketball. And, you know, that there, these just these huge gyms aren't being filled up. In the video, the Bloomington South coach, J.R. Holmes, talked about the gyms are just wall-to-wall packed when you've got players like Romeo Langford or Damon Bailey, where Bedford would travel to Seymour to watch Damon go to the finals, or, you know, New Albany's following Romeo Langford around.
And so they just don't quite fill up the same way. Does it, what does it take anymore to fill up these gyms like that?
Probably a special player, a phenom. You know, I, at the paper, I went and covered a regional game against Romeo Langford and Trace Jackson Davis played each other. So it was Center Grove and New Albany over at Seymour, and Bloomington South was another team in that. And that was packed, you know, a lot of Archie Miller was there recruiting. Trace Jackson Davis's dad, Dale Davis, was sitting in the crowd. So that was definitely a hyped moment. It was really neat to be on the baseline for that kind of game.
What do you think that this says, the declining attendance? You don't see these consistent games where you have thousands of people showing up. What does this say about the future of Indiana high school basketball?
I asked the same question to Tom McKinney, and he said back in the day there were just people have so many more alternatives to do now on a Friday night. There's so many other things that people could be doing, occupying their time. And then, you know, back in the day when those things weren't around, everybody went and saw the local high school basketball game. And so, unfortunately, it might not be something that people can get back when the whole town shows up on a Friday night to watch the game.
What about you? Do you still find yourself going to high school games? Just a few seconds left.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a lot of fun, and I really enjoy it and miss it from when I was in high school.
We really appreciate you coming in to talk Indiana high school gyms with us today. Seth Tackett, chief videographer at WTIU, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, we're asking why basketball is a cornerstone of culture here in Indiana. What made the sport and the state a duo that inspired movies, legends, and generations of players, coaches, and fans? As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Is Hoosier hysteria a phenomenon that you're all too familiar with? Or do you have questions about Indiana's basketball history? We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're exploring the history of Indiana basketball as we head into March Madness, a phrase that may have its roots in Indiana. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We would love to hear from you today. In the studio now, we're joined by Dale Ogden, the former chief curator of cultural history at the Indiana State Museum. Dale, glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Chandler Lightly, the executive director of the Indiana Archives and Records. Chandler, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
And joining us from Newcastle, Indiana, is Chris May, the executive director of the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. Chris, thanks for making the time.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Chris, we were just talking about some of the mammoth high school gyms in Indiana, and you're joining us from Newcastle, which boasted the largest gym in the country for years. But the list was recently recalibrated, and Newcastle now ranks as the third largest gym in the state. What does that gym mean to Newcastle?
Well, it's a huge source of identity and has been since it opened in November of 1959. If you speak to people anywhere around the state who have not been to Newcastle, they likely know of a basketball connection, whether it's the Fieldhouse or a famous player like Steve Alford or Kent Benson, or maybe as the home of our organization and museum. But it's a spot where, as you referenced with Seth in the previous segment, approximately half the town's people could come, congregate, and root on the hometown Trojans, so it means a lot.
How often has that happened in more recent years when you've packed the house?
Yeah, not nearly as frequently in recent years, and I think that you and Seth covered a little bit of that as well. You know, the attention span and the entertainment, the vying for entertainment attention has just grown immensely. And so attendance at high school basketball, not just in Newcastle, but throughout the state, is not what it used to be. And so it is a more rare occurrence, although I can't say a year ago this week, the sectional last season drew not an entirely sold-out crowd, but quite a filled facility here in Newcastle.
That was going to be my next question. What does it take for you to come close? Is it big events like that, star players, like we mentioned in the last segment as well?
Right. There was a unique circumstance a year ago in this sectional, which is a Class 3A sectional. Delta, which is not far away, was undefeated with, I think, a 20-0 record coming into the tournament. Blackford was here, and they have a notable player, Luke Brown, who's averaged over 30 points a game for his career and has a chance to continue to climb the state's all-time scoring records. The hometown Newcastle team had Indiana All-Star player that was headed to Ball State. And, yeah, it takes the right circumstances, the right teams, and star power does tend to draw well, and that's also something we see. We host the Hall of Fame Classic Tournament in December and have high school All-Americans and future Division I stars, and that is what helps pull a crowd these days.
Chandler, let's talk about some of the history behind basketball in the state. For starters, what is the origin story of basketball, the sport in general? Where did it first originate?
Well, the sport started in Springfield, Massachusetts at the YMCA training school there. In the winter of 1891-92. James Naismith, the sports inventor, almost immediately published the rules in the YMCA's publication.
The 13 rules.
Yep. And then that was disseminated to YMCAs throughout the country. And in Indiana, pretty much any YMCA in the state could have seen that, started playing immediately if they wanted to. The first documented instances, though, come later in the fall of 1892. There is one instance of the basketball reportedly being played in North Manchester in the summer of 1892, but most of the others are later in the fall.
So what's the official story of how basketball found its way to Indiana?
The official story or what I've found? Traditionally, this is based upon a newspaper article from the 1940s. A newspaper journalist for the Indianapolis, one of the Indianapolis newspapers, claimed that the first game took place in March of 1894 in Crawfordsville. A few jobs back, I was heavily involved with digitizing newspapers and started doing some keyword searches and found a much more complicated history. There's actually a What the earliest intercity game that I know of was actually Evansville versus Terre Haute's YMCA's in January of 1894. So it depends on what you're classifying as first game. I mean, is that the first time the game was practiced or the first intercity game? I guess it depends on your definition. But it what's clear is that the sport disseminated and, you know, it was a very small D democratic process where it's popping up all over the place in a matter of months.
Chris, today we think of basketball as 5-on-5. We think of sneakers against hardwood floors and the echoes of the dribbles in the gymnasiums. But how different did the game of basketball look back in 1894 when it first made its way to Indiana? Did we even have hoops yet?
Not as you would expect them and find them today. In Dr. Naismith's first playing of the game in December of 1891, it was 9 players per side. So you had 18 players on the floor at one time.
Crowded.
In a room smaller than the measurements of the current 84 by 50 court for high school games. And the score was 1-0. So we've advanced a lot. The game is played dramatically, drastically differently. When it was first invented, there was a center jump after every basket that was scored, as few baskets that might be. And yes, in the early days, it is called basketball because James Naismith used a peach basket in the Springfield, Massachusetts YMCA. Many, many modifications and changes have come along the way and changed the way the sport is watched and played as well as watched.
Dale, it's been said that Indiana was made for basketball and basketball was made for Indiana. What were the conditions that allowed basketball to take such a hold in the state?
Well, it was an easy game to organize for small schools. Indiana being the conservative and relatively rural state that it is, or particularly was, had lots and lots and lots of small schools. I'm from Kosciuszko County, and as recently as the late 1960s, there were 11 different high schools in Kosciuszko County, which is, at that time particularly, was a very rural, small-town county. Warsaw was the largest city in the county, and it only had 6,000 people. There were towns like Leesburg and Atwood and Claypool that had, you know, barely 30 kids in their school who were fielding basketball teams. You only needed five guys. You needed at least five. But if you had five or six or seven, it might be almost every male in your school, but it was enough to field a basketball team. And it wasn't expensive. You didn't need, you know, helmets and blocking sleds and anything like that. You just needed a ball and a court. So small towns could put a team on the floor as recently, like I say, as less than 50 years ago. It was inexpensive. You didn't need, you know, a cow pasture to play. You didn't need that much in the way of equipment, and there were plenty of other schools to play. You didn't have to go more than, you know, 20 miles to find 10 different schools to play. So being a small state, a comparatively rural state, and a conservative state that was late to consolidate a lot of its high schools, pretty much every little community in the state of Indiana had its own team.
Chandler, do you agree? What do you think made the state and the sport such a match? How did it take such a hold here?
I think Dale's onto a lot there. Some of the research I've done is about the Wingate teams of 1913 and 14. And, you know, you think Milan was a small school. Wingate probably had 70 students max. And so, I mean, in Wingate's case, getting together five, six guys for a team was a significant advantage.
So it's not so much that it's not so much inter-community competition, which basketball certainly is, but you can do that with anything. You can do that with baseball. You can do that with football. But it's the fact that you don't need as many guys. You don't need as much equipment, but you do need the facility. And does that, so that goes back to the gymnasiums, but that's a significant investment as well. You're not investing so much in equipment, but the facilities are a big part of it. But communities came together and they would put these gymnasiums up, and then you've got your place.
Exactly. So in 1915, Thorntown wins the state championship. Thorntown's, you know, it was bigger than Wingate, but still a pretty small town. I think about 1,000 residents at the time. And what you see in Thorntown is the community really mobilizing, especially after the team wins the championship, and they build a gym. I mean, prior to that, they played their championship season playing in a multi-purpose room with columns in the middle of the floor, and
yeah.
So you do see that all across the board. It building a, I mean, not like building a church or a new school in these communities. Building a gym was a real point of pride for a lot of these communities.
And some of these historic gyms in Indiana, I mean, you look at exterior pictures, and some of them just look like barns. But they were palaces for the time, I suppose. Chris, when do we see true organized tournaments starting to take place here in Indiana?
Well, the first statewide tournament occurred in 1911, and it actually was organized by the IU Booster Club. The Indiana High School Athletic Association existed, but hadn't yet organized a true statewide tournament. And in 1911, Crawfordsville won that first state championship. 12 teams went to Bloomington. It was designed to have a representative from each of Indiana's 13 congressional districts, but the Indianapolis district apparently didn't think it was official enough or held much merit, so they didn't send a team. And 12 teams met in Bloomington in 1911. And then thereafter, the Indiana High School Athletic Association got on board as sponsoring the tournament, organizing the tournament, and it really grew from there.
Dale, you're the former chief curator of cultural history at the Indiana State Museum. Can you talk about how basketball found its way into the museum while you were there?
Sure. The State Museum, not surprisingly, was another conservative cultural institution in Indiana. Traditionally, our collection consisted of wedding dresses and rocks and a few unidentified Civil War objects and such. The director at the time, we're talking mid-1980s, wanted to expand what the State Museum dealt with, and he asked me to look into putting together a sports collection for the State Museum, which was relatively revolutionary for an organization that was run by volunteers and such. The first person who really stepped up, which opened the floodgates for us, was Bobby Plump. Bobby, sort of the inspiration for Hoosiers that you talked about earlier, has lived in Indianapolis for many decades. And he was not real enthusiastic about the Hall of Fame leaving Indianapolis. And so he kind of split his collection up a little bit between the Hall of Fame in Newcastle and the State Museum. He wanted to continue to maintain a presence in Indianapolis. And at that time, we were right across the street from Market Square Arena. So he saw that as sort of a nexus of Indiana basketball history in that area. And so in order to maintain that presence in Indianapolis, he gave us some memorabilia, both from Milan and also from his career at Butler. People don't realize that Bobby went on to have a really extraordinary basketball career after Milan, both playing in the Industrial League, which was major, major athletic competition in the 1950s, and before that at Butler. So he kind of opened the floodgates for us. Once I could send out letters saying, Bobby Plump's on board here, the collection grew. I contacted the sports information directors at IU and Purdue and told them that the other one was being more cooperative. And so they wanted to get on board. Purdue didn't want a bigger IU footprint than they had. So it's just one thing led to another, and we ended up with a pretty good collection, not the kind of collection that's in Newcastle. Ron Newland, who really established the Hall of Fame in Newcastle, really did an extraordinary job of collecting incredible artifacts.
We talked a little bit about Hoosiers and Bobby Plump and the 1954 Milan team. Chandler, do you think that that movie accurately depicts what basketball culture looked like in Indiana towns at that time?
I defer to Chris or Dale on that.
Chris, what about you? Do you think so? Do you think they got it right?
As somebody who didn't live through that era, culturally it seems so. It's obviously not a documentary about Milan, which some folks who visit our facility that aren't from Indiana don't know that that movie was fictionalized quite a bit in certain respects. But you are talking about, especially in the 1950s, which I would say was probably the glory years, the heyday of Indiana high school basketball at its pinnacle, in which communities were rabid for their high school teams. As one of our panelists mentioned, it was the pre-consolidation, right before that consolidation wave hit. So you had, at its peak, I believe there were 787 teams in the IHSA state tournament at its peak. And so no matter where you were, you had a school close by. And of course, that was the one-class system in which the small schools had a chance to try to knock off the county seat and the bigger schools. And that was, in my opinion, Indiana high school basketball at its best.
So it allowed for this sort of David and Goliath type games, the one class system. Is that sort of thing? We don't really see that anymore because we have the multiple class system now.
The dynamic has changed. And to be honest, if you would talk to us, some of the folks who played in those eras or were fans in those eras, to so many schools, winning a sectional championship would have been the highlight of a lifetime or was the highlight of a lifetime. Winning a state championship was not on their radar. But if they could beat the county seat, As someone referenced with the Kosciuszko scenario, if Leesburg could beat Warsaw, those guys were heroes in Leesburg or from Leesburg for the rest of their lives. And that was what really encapsulated what high school basketball in Indiana had come to be and why it was such a big part of our society.
I want to talk about the term Hoosier hysteria. Is that tied to this notion of a big, grand underdog upset?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I think Hoosier hysteria encapsulates the passion in which people, whether you were a parent of a player, people who had no connection as far as families are concerned to players, it was the end-all be-all. And come this week, sectional week of the state tournament, this was just, again, the highlight of the basketball season because everybody wanted a ticket. And there are countless examples of, you know, not only were the sectionals sold out, the state tournament, the state finals at Butler Fieldhouse were sold out for a number of decades because whether or not you had a connection to that specific team, everybody wanted to see can the underdog beat the favorite? Can the small school beat the big school? Those things were immensely important in our state.
Chris May is the executive director of the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. We're also joined by Dale Ogden, former chief curator of cultural history at the Indiana State Museum, and Chandler Lightly, executive director of Indiana Archives and Records. And when we come back, we'll be joined by a man who runs a website that collects the schedules and scores of every Indiana high school basketball team in the state. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on the history of basketball in Indiana. We're talking about the roots behind phrases like Hoosier hysteria and March Madness and asking what the sport can teach us about Indiana history and culture. And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881, and we'll try to get you into the conversation today. We're joined again by Chandler Lighty, the executive director of Indiana Archives and Records, Dale Ogden, the former chief curator of cultural history at the Indiana State Museum. Chris May is on the phone with us. He's executive director of Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. And now we're going to welcome John Harrell to the program from Bloomington. John runs a website that collects the schedules and scores from every Indiana high school basketball game across the state. John, thanks for joining us today.
Well, no problem. Thank you.
I think your website, John, is a testament to how much high school basketball means to some Hoosiers. Can you talk about what you post on your website?
Yes, you're right. Schedules, scores, standings, predictions. everything comes with it. Ratings, of course. And I enjoy it.
And
I think I'm sure a lot of people, you know, it really started out as just something for the media, because I worked at the Herald Press, Herald Times, and New Sentinel for maybe a 50-year period, and so I was always a media guy, and this was a way to give back and also help out those media people.
But it's a bit of
Fans have picked up on it, yes.
Yeah, it's a big undertaking. I mean, that's a lot of stat keeping, numbers, and it's also a lot of cooperation you get from people. How do you get people on board with sending you all the info?
Well, I guess because it's there and they know they want it there. But you're right. Athletic directors, you know, send me all sorts of things. Coaches keep me informed. Even other website owners email me and tell me, you know, correct me or update me. So I get a lot of people that help out.
And I hear you make predictions on who will win each game. Any idea what your track record looks like?
Oh, not really. But it gets me in trouble sometimes, yes. And I'm sure it becomes a bulletin board fodder for a lot of schools who are underdogs for a certain game.
Yeah,
I've also noticed. Yeah, excuse me.
No, it's fine. It gives people something to, I guess, to shoot for, to challenge against. We're gonna challenge against John's predictions.
Yes, yes, and also even officials say they like it because they want to know if the game's going to be a blowout or not.
We have a listener voicemail from Linda in Elkhart. Let's listen to that now.
I can remember Northside Gym when my dad would go for a lottery in order to get tickets for basketball games. He was always lucky, but there were a lot that weren't. Northside Gym used to be filled to the rafters.
Dale, do you remember, have you heard stories about those days when you couldn't even get in?
I'm from Warsaw, and Warsaw always had the sectional. And there was a little tiny consolidated school called Triton. It was a consolidation of Bourbon and Etna Green, which between them probably didn't have 1,500 people. And Triton High School built a larger gymnasium than Warsaw had in order to steal the sectional from the county seat. And then when Warsaw built their, well, it's not new anymore, high school, they made sure that their gymnasium had 100 seats bigger than Triton did. So they got the sectional back. So, yeah, it was, we were talking at the break, my senior year, the girls' cheer block at Warsaw High School had 400 girls in it.
Wow. And this is just the cheer block.
That's just the cheer block. That's just the organized in sweaters, in the matching sweaters.
This is the block that supports the cheerleaders.
Supports the cheerleaders, yeah.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure that you get 400 at a typical Indiana high school basketball game anymore, let alone in the girls' cheer block. I don't even know if they still have girls' cheer blocks.
I know there was always a cheering section. I used to announce games at my high school and things like that. And there was always the senior section. But that was almost 20 years ago now. We have another listener voicemail. This one's from Fred in Lafayette, who has a story. Let's listen to Fred.
In the 1950s, there were about 6 grade schools in Warren County, Indiana. And we were the only grade school that did not have a gym. We played on cinders, which was a refuge from coal burning, and we won the county tourney in the grade school division, beating Williamsport, which was the county seat. That was a huge win for us, and the next day we had a big celebration, and everybody got out from school.
Thanks for calling, Fred. It was stories like that I really, really was hoping that we would get today. Chris, you're the executive director of the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. For those of us who have never been, can you tell us a little bit about the place?
Sure. We are approaching our 30th anniversary here, opening in June of 1990. It's a 14,000-square-foot museum, and we've got the jerseys and trophies and artifacts that you would come to expect, but also in the modern age, the interactive exhibits. As a Hall of Fame, obviously we have an enshrinement gallery with the bios and profiles of some of our state's best players, coaches, administrators, and others. We have an introductory film. It's titled Only in Indiana, in which our visitors hear from the likes of Oscar Robertson and Larry Bird and Bobby Plump and Steve Alford and George McGinnis and Damon Bailey and so on and so forth about their experiences, what growing up in Indiana, what playing basketball in Indiana was all about. And then, as I said, the exhibits that immerse them not only in the history of the sport, but also the history of our state that are told through certain communities, certain teams, certain people who have attained success on the basketball floor.
And when you're talking about certain teams in basketball history in Indiana, you've got to talk about Crispus Attucks. That's a significant example of where state history meets basketball. Can you tell us the story behind that team?
Precisely. Crispus Attucks High School won the Indiana High School State Championships in 1955 and 1956. Their star player, Oscar Robertson, would go on to become arguably the greatest player of all time in the sport's history. In winning the 1955 state tournament, they've gained attention for being an all-African-American school, declared the first in the United States to win a state championship in any sport open to white schools and African-American schools. But also in state history, they became the first Indianapolis city school to win the high school state championship. And again, as you look at the timeline of basketball in our state, what began in the rural areas and with the small schools over time, along with population moving to the cities, you also saw that change in that the city schools in the high school game became more successful and had more state tournament runs as well. In 1956, they won again. This was Oscar Robertson's senior year. They were undefeated state champions that year. And over the course of those two seasons, they lost just one time and are widely regarded as one of, if not the best, high school teams in Indiana's history.
Dale, what influence, if any, did these victories, the 55 and 56 victory at Crispus Attucks, what influence did they have on our city, who were at the time working its way through segregation?
Yeah, I think it's just really interesting that Milan won in 54 and then Attucks won in 55 and 56. I mean, that just is almost too much of a coincidence to even believe. I mean, if you were to write that as part of the Hoosier story, I think people would go, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It just really showed, I think Attucks, there was a lot of criticism in Indianapolis at the time that Attucks sort of had some sort of unfair advantage of being just phenomenal athletes. And they really weren't like Milan had the reputation of being disciplined and, you know, organized and well coached and just a great team. And Attucks was widely criticized of just being a bunch of great athletes who happened to be on the floor all at the same time. And there was the sports editor of the Indianapolis Star at the time, Bob Collins, was a big supporter of Crispus Attucks. And he just put an end to that nonsense once and for all. He said the reason these guys are winning is because they're the most disciplined team in the state of Indiana. They have the best coach in the state of Indiana, Ray Crow. They are the best basketball team in the state of Indiana. And it really kind of took the conversation away from, you know, the white teams are good because they're disciplined and smart and organized and play basketball the way it's supposed to be played. And Attucks is this sort of anomaly. Once Attucks just proved over and over and over and over again that they were the best basketball team in the state, that argument just got harder and harder and harder to make. It eventually became the nonsense that it was.
We have a listener voicemail from William who left a question for us. Let's listen to William.
I have a question for your group. What is the oldest gymnasium in the state of Indiana? Because I know the gym at the Athenaeum was finished in 1894 and has been in continuous use since then. So that's what I'd like to know, the oldest gymnasium in the state. Thank you.
Do we have that answer? Athenaeum, 1894, the year that basketball made it to Indiana. I mean, that could give the rest of the gyms a run for their money, but I wish I had an answer for that.
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is a lot of the gyms were, you know, YMCA and used for other athletic purposes and mm-hmm. not necessarily basketball related. But
yeah, I don't know when they put a basketball hoop in the gymnasium at the Athenaeum. My wife used to be the director of the YMCA there, and it was gymnastics. It was actually the home of the U.S. Gymnastics Federation. And I'm not sure that it wasn't several decades after that before, you know, basketball hoops were actually installed in that gymnasium.
Let's transition to college basketball. Chris, Indiana has a reputation for producing quality players that go on to perform really well at both the collegiate and the professional level. What does that legacy look like, and is it still strong today?
Absolutely. I believe this season there are 16 Indiana high school graduates playing on NBA rosters. And throughout time, a study was done, I think, in the middle part of the last decade, and per capita, Indiana has produced more professional basketball players than any other state. And it's not a trend that's just a recent fad. And if you look on the college level, there were Indiana natives like Everett Case, who went to North Carolina State and really introduced basketball at a serious level in the southeastern part of the United States. Coach Wells, Cliff Wells, went to Tulane in New Orleans and did much the same down in that part of the state and recruited Indiana players to come to their programs. And so there has been a long line of outstanding high school players from our state going on to become college All-Americans, professional players, and have success at all levels.
Chandler, speaking of college basketball, can Indiana claim responsibility for coining the term March Madness?
There seems to be good evidence for that. I can't take credit for this. A few years ago, when I was director of the Indiana Historical Bureau, I was contacted by an etymologist. That's not the person who studies insects, right? That's
it. Yeah, okay. Indeed, yeah. So,
guy named Barry Popick, and he shared with me his findings that what he believes the earliest instance of the term March Madness in a basketball context appeared in the Evansville Press sports section on March 25th, 1938, under the title Indiana in Grip of Its Annual March Madness. I guess there's been some that's not the accepted tradition, but Barry's research seems to be spot on. Illinois actually claims to have coined the term, but Barry's research seems to contradict that.
Was it not referring to college basketball, or was it just referring to basketball in general and the strong high school tradition that we have?
Yeah, I mean, in that context, it was talking about high school basketball.
John, in your time following Indiana high school basketball, what has changed? That's a big question. There's a lot.
Yeah, you know, the number of teams dwindled down. I was in middle school in the 50s, so I remember how big the schools were, how big the tournament was, how many teams were in the sectionals. You know, 16 teams. Now you get 5 to 8. That's been the main thing, I think, that it has hurt. You know, there just aren't many schools left anymore.
Chris, what do you predict the future looks like for high school basketball in Indiana?
I don't have that crystal ball. As we've referenced, attendance is not what it once was. In fact, I'm looking, tonight is the opening night of sectionals, and there are 16 games that I can watch on my TV or my tablet or my computer screen. And so I think people will continue to follow it. I don't know that the attendance will continue. And there truthfully are other issues at hand. Officials, referees are in other sports especially reaching crisis mode. And I think basketball probably is headed towards a situation there. And the span of coaches, the coaching career is getting shorter and shorter in the high school level. It's year-round now. There are stresses with parents and school boards, et cetera, et cetera. And so I am interested in that myself, and I don't know that I have the exact answer.
We've talked about the shortage of officials across all sports in Indiana. Why is there such a shortage?
Well, as it pertains to high school basketball, the new officials that are getting involved mostly have an eye on trying to get into the college game or think that they're going to become professional or big-time major college conference officials. So a lot of the younger people that do get involved are trying to move up that ladder as quickly as possible and don't stay with the high school game. I think someone told me recently the average age of an Indiana high school official is 51. And in a sport where you have to get up and down the floor, Mother Time is undefeated. You can't keep up. And so there's going to have to be something done to either keep those younger and newer officials in the high school game or make some other way of addressing the issue.
Chris May is the executive director of the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Dale Ogden, the former chief curator of cultural history at the Indiana State Museum, thanks for your insight today.
Pleasure to be here.
Chandler Leidy, the executive director of Indiana Archives and Records, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Matt.
And John Harrell, who runs johnharrell.net. Check it out. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. And subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Tomorrow, we'll talk to the author of a new book that takes an in-depth look at how the American Midwest has been portrayed in film and literature. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.